Hello and welcome to Bah Humbug, a podcast about the cuddliest of all movie genres, the Christmas movie. My name is Helen O'Hara and I'll be guiding the reindeer this foggy Christmas night. Wait, hang on, does that make me Rudolph? Today we're going to be talking, however, about Christmas Chronicles 2, which is new this year on Netflix, and we'll be contrasting that with 1994's The Santa Claus. Will this new contender soon be joining the ranks of the Christmas classics, or will it fall prey to an overlooked provision in the small print? Well, with me to find out are two of the world's greatest Christmas movie experts, two people who can recite chapter and verse on all Santa-related contracts. First up, I'm delighted to welcome film journalist, Bechdel Film Fest co-runner and Empire contributing editor, Beth Webb. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I've got a festive jumper on and very excited to get stuck in today to some bad Santas.
I mean, that's not unfair. Bad, possibly in different meanings of the word for both. And we're also joined by another of my favourite people, Ali Plum, who is the Radio 1 film critic and creator of its fantastic Movies That Made Me series. How are you doing, Ali? So many Christmas movies. Ooh. I mean, I'm only covering a fraction of them because, quite frankly, I watched Christmasland and Christmas Wonderland, two different films, and immediately lost the will to live. So, you know, I didn't think I should inflict that on any of my guests. But these ones I didn't feel quite so bad about. But just to kind of calibrate before we get started, you know, tell me your attitudes to Christmas movies as a whole. Are you an elf or more of a Grinch?
For me, the worse the better a lot of the time. Like, I like them as cheesy as they can get. I mean, if you pushed me from a favorite Christmas film, I do have to be boring and say It's a Wonderful Life because it's a sure. It's a lifelong family tradition there. But I love a cheesy Christmas film and I love a secret Christmas film. So I'm talking about your Die Hards. I'm talking about your Eyes Wide Shuts. I'm talking about a recent entry in the canon, which is Hustlers. So that's my general tune is cheesy, often terrible, and like garish and brilliant is like my general taste.
Fair enough. I can respect that. Ali, how about you?
I think I like any movie that holds up to repeat viewings and you still find more and more to them. And there's something about the quantity and varying quality of Christmas movies where we can all get on board what is sometimes a difficult train to ride, which is this movie's terrible. I love it. So sometimes I'm trying to convince people to watch, I don't know, some cut price bargain bin end of the Asda queue Jason Statham movie. And they're like, why would I press play on War, for example? And I'm like, because it's funny and there are some good bits and there are some terrible bits. When it's Christmas, we are all aboard this train. The Polar Express to Not That Very Good Town is full steam ahead. And I love that. I love that we can all kind of feel that vibe of, I know the holiday isn't good cinema, but I love the bit where, you know, let's say Cameron Diaz starts bopping up and down to The Killers, whatever, you know, getting to a tent with Jude Law. So that sort of stuff. I love that about Christmas. But I will say this, 2 points really, basically, I reckon. When you try to critically appraise, as a film journalist, Christmas movies, you are walking into a minefield.
Because
if I step up and say, well, if we actually take a little moment to discuss the strengths of Nightmare Before Christmas.
The mise-en-scène, if you will.
The kind of person like myself who presses play on this podcast, for example, Santa Claus, right, Christmas Chronicles, you probably like them, otherwise you wouldn't have pressed play. So I step up and go, well, actually, the third act really falls apart. It's like, what am I doing? So I find it often quite tough to properly go, is it a good film? It's more, let's just talk about it, which, if you don't mind, I'll probably be doing more of than actually digging into it.
Well, to be honest, I am going to ask you both at the end to rate them, because we've been asking everybody to rate them on Christmassiness and quality as two separate concepts.
Really wide.
Okay, so thinking caps on for that. But I agree completely. There is an element of bonus points you get for being a Christmas movie, which, you know, can offset a remarkable lack of quality in some cases. so it is worth bearing that in mind. And that is why I sort of split those two up, because some films are extremely Christmassy and therefore get a lot more leeway than perhaps they might deserve at other times of the year, if we're honest. But I also do love critiquing these films from a place of love.
Yeah,
you know, I've watched them all more than once. But it is undeniable that some of them are quite bad, as you say. So, okay, so let's talk about these two films. Let me just set the two up. We are going to go into spoilers. So if you haven't seen these two yet and you think you care about spoilers for them, please do be warned. Go away, watch them, come back if you like. But Christmas Chronicles 2 is directed by old Christmas hand Chris Columbus, and try and say that fast. It sees Kurt Russell return as the disturbingly sexy Santa Claus, with Goldie Hawn as his Mrs. Claus, and they face another tough Christmas. That's because Kate Pierce, played by Darby Camp, who's the star of the first film, she's now a little bit older, and she's unhappy that her mum, played by Kimberly Williams-Paisley, is potentially getting remarried to her new boyfriend Bob, played by Tyrese Gibson. Well done, Kimberly. But she and Bob's anxious son, Jack, played by Jazeera Bruno, get sucked through a wormhole back to the North Pole from their Hawaiian vacation. And she once again meets up with Santa and discovers that their predicament is all down to the connivance of a former elf called Belle Snickle, played by Hunt for the Wilder People's Julian Dennison. And he's determined to end Christmas once and for all. It's quite complicated and really probably didn't need to be. Anyway. Then The Santa Claus, which is directed by John Pasquin, stars Tim Allen as Scott Calvin, who's a toy company executive trying to adjust to divorced life and shared company of his son Charlie, played by Eric Lloyd. But one Christmas night, Scott startles Santa, who falls off the roof and dies, which is a very Christmassy start to a movie. So Scott puts on his suit to finish Santa's deliveries at his son's behest. But that means that the Santa Clause in the small print kicks in, and he must now become the new Father Christmas, while facing the fact that everyone who knows him thinks he might be a little bit crazy. Everyone's confused by the changes in his appearance as he becomes more Santa-y, and he faces losing custody of his son because of his claim that he is the real Santa Claus. So, I mean, I'll be honest, some of the films that I've paired for this show, I've had to explain why I put them together. My thinking in this case is literally Santa's. So that's it. But what did you think of the two as a sort of comparison?
Well, I like that in both of them, they are far from what I would call jolly. I think they're both, when they say bad, I mean more in the vein of kind of badass. So you've got Kurt Russell, obviously, who has taken some time out of some pretty, outside of these films, he's done what, Bone Tomahawk, he's done Fast and the Furious, he's done Quentin Tarantino films, and then just sort of sidestepped to kind of go up to do these two entries. But I love that he's got this kind of badass dude where he's got the sunglasses. He does a musical number in this one, which is quite good to have him. But yeah, he's got a real sense of, like, there's no laughing at him for this. Like, he's taking it really quite seriously, which is pretty great. And then the same with Tim Allen in The Santa Claus. Like, there's nothing merry about a custody battle. But he's, like, obviously embroiled in that and in his own kind of sense of trying to work out who he is. And then at the same time, transforming into a bit of a daddy. So I think there's, like, something to be said about how these two men are portrayed. Like, it's not the kind of wholesome sort of soft-bellied, they are both soft-bellied, but the kind of soft-bellied lads that we so often associate Father Christmas with.
I feel like Kurt Russell's Santa would want us to point out he's not soft-bellied. He makes a big thing of that in the first film, that his belly is actually quite flat. So I just want to say that on his behalf right here. Yeah. Ali, how about you?
I think this taps into the other side of kind of assessing a Christmas movie, is that, how can I put this? The plots often get really overly complicated because there isn't enough tale to tell in of the Christmassy side. So I've always loved the concept of the Santa Claus. Even as a kid, it delighted me, the idea that you could, without necessarily realizing it, become Santa, because you can't be Santa forever. There's an accident. You might want to retire. But if you put on the trousers and you put on the jacket, then kind of actually you're Santa. And I love the idea. That is a dream I think we've all had of, what if our dad, what if our mum, if our parents were Santa? That's a great idea. Yeah. And there's that lovely wordplay pun, and I'll watch any movie based on a pun, Toy Story, Arthur Christmas. I love it. So I think the concept is great, but there's not enough mileage for a 90-minute movie. So what do they do? It's a custody battle film. It's Kramer versus Kringle. It's unbelievable that they turn this film into what is so unkiddy. If you compare it to Christmas Chronicles, it is, I think, a perfect example of over-universe expansion. The first film is they go on an adventure. The second film is the elves, and there are bad elves, and then there's the Christmas Bethlehem star, but we're not going to talk too much about Jesus. And there are some other elves in Turkey, and it's this humongous, you know, overcomplication of what is essentially at first a simple Christmas story. So you can see the writers going, but then what happens? So so Tim Allen is Santa now. Okay, and then what happens? And they have to kind of cook up this, frankly, dull. As a kid, I must have been bored off my seat. I remember the first 15 minutes going, brilliant. Falling off, he's a grump, he becomes Santa, he doesn't like it. And then later on, there's the whole like, oh, I've eaten too much and I can't stop having milk. And as a child, that is good. But with 20/20 glasses on, it's not great. But I see what, I can feel them writing the scene going, this is working. And then you're writing a bit where the, you know, the psychiatrist stepdad figure and the mum are having realizations about what they last asked for as a Christmas present. And you go, oh. You want an adventure. You want excitement. You want Santa being Santa, and you want the dream of your dad becoming Saint Nick. But but wouldn't you say, watching it, please agree with me, there were moments of just going, this is ultimately a custody battle movie where one of them is Santa.
Yeah, it's also a bit of a body horror movie.
It is.
Where, like, it's quite horrific, the Santa Claus. This idea that, you know, he loses control of his own body. He's suddenly not just going grey. We've all been there, and, you know, that's what L'Oreal is for. But he's literally, he can't shave without immediately regrowing a full beard. His body's completely changing. He still is fit. We see him go to the doctor and do his running tests. He's still a fit person. But he's now carrying this, you know, belly like a bowl full of jelly or whatever. It is quite horrific in some respects, and it's, you know, it's early CG. I think it holds up reasonably well. Mostly.
The transformation in the mirror, I'm not saying it's a werewolf in London, but it's not terrible. Maybe it is werewolf in London.
The reindeer are a bit shaky.
The reindeer are shaky. Yeah. That's fair.
I actually quite like how he disappears down the chimneys or the small pipes or whatever he does. I think that kind of floating and then going, whoop, that's kind of a fun cartoony thing. I do think the beard coming back is horrific. A lot of what he goes through is horrible. And the other thing that Christmas movies can have come a cropper with is that it has to be based around Christmas, as in the time, as in it has to be the end of the year. But if you're doing a custody battle thing, you've got 9, 10, 11 months of so... Right. It's terrible being a kid in this situation.
And it sort of has to skip briskly through those intervening months so it can begin and end at Christmas. And it's the thing about the Christmas thing, that, and it comes up in every single Santa movie, I think I'm right in saying, is that it sets this deadline. Yeah. Everything has to happen by midnight Christmas Eve. It has to. And so everything, Fred Claus, Arthur Christmas, you know, Miracle on 34th Street even, you know, the sort of most restrained of all Santa movies, it has to happen by midnight on Christmas Eve. And that means that there is always this temptation to make it some giant quest that has to be completed by that time.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. Is it all right if I broached the topic of just Tim Allen generally?
Yeah, I think we should probably touch on that.
Because I watched this film, and like I say, I really like the conceit. I would like the movie to have just been an adventure film, like the first Christmas Chronicles. Like, they go on an adventure together. The son and the dad bond. They've been estranged, but now they get together and they're actually having a lovely, jolly time. That's what I would like the movie to have been, and not to have been a custody battle. That's my big pitch. But I think, at first I was like, oh, is Tim Allen the right casting for this? Because if you go for the Tom Hanks guy, you don't buy Tom Hanks as being a total... arse.
Yeah.
And Tim Allen can sell arse, so to speak.
He can.
What he can't necessarily do is make me love him.
No, I would agree with you there.
But if you, Bill Murray is the king of this. Groundhog Day is a miracle because of him and many other reasons. But part of it is because you can believe him as an ass and you can believe him as a good guy.
Mm. Yeah. And that's Scrooged as well.
Scrooged, exactly. That people can acknowledge the Ghostbusters grumpiness of him. And that's what makes him magical. Tim Allen can give me the grumpy, I've burnt the turkey, I'm going to look at other kids and their parents in this horrible fast food joint moment. And I can buy it, but I can't quite love him.
His sincerity is not as convincing as his sarcasm,
yes,
basically.
He doesn't have... I want him to have the Tom Hanks side better. I don't think he's terribly cast at all. There are just moments where I felt like I should have been like, oh, yes, snuggly and lovely, and I'm glad he's doing well. Whereas in reality, I'm like, oh, you're a bit of a... Yeah.
The kid does a lot of the heavy lifting in that film, I think.
And it's
only, emotionally, yeah.
Absolutely. And in terms of... I think he becomes, Tim Allen becomes more likable the more the relationship with the kid strengthens. I think you're completely right, Ali. It's he's got this wholesome sort of, actually he's not got the sort of wholesome dad cut out lockdown, which is, you know, obviously what we see or saw in Home Improvements. But yeah, it's tough. He's tough to love.
And I mean, is some of that coming from sort of hindsight? Because, you know, in the 90s, like, he was coming off Home Improvement, he was, you know, kind of riding a bit of a wave. Is some of this the fact that perhaps he, you know, he's had some controversies in the past coming through that we didn't know about maybe when we first saw this?
They're not in my mind as I'm rewatching this. I honestly and truly mean it. I'm watching this with 1990s goggles the best I can. I think he manages to sell lines like he's not a doctor, he's a psychologist or whatever. I think he manages to say, yes, his head goes into a point. And it's like, it's not that funny, but you're actually giving a little bit of bitter twistedness. And I kind of like, you know, he gets away with quite a few of the lines, like when I wake up and all that stuff. And he's got to do a little bit of the, oh, I'm wearing the pajamas that I was given in the North Pole. You know, I don't want to dismiss him. I just feel like I would like to have seen... maybe a Chris Pratt? Is that a crazy idea? If they were to...
We are due a remake, I feel like.
Genuinely think this is a movie which is a good example of a good core conceit, but the actual storyline isn't very fun. And I think if you took that good core conceit and made them go on an adventure or gave them some actual peril that wasn't to do with the breakdown of a family and a child losing his mind, this movie's idea is that he's kind of sort of being gaslit by reality. That's horrible. You're a 9-year-old or whatever, and the truth will not set you free. You have to live a secret life where you know the ultimate truth about Christmas. No one else can know because your dad said I'd give you $5.
Yeah. I think you've just hit the nail on the head of why I never loved the Santa movie, the Santa Claus, even as a kid. There is a sort of harshness to it underneath for the most part, but you feel it there. It's really quite traumatic that Charlie goes through all this, and even Scott is telling him, no, it was just a dream, no, it didn't happen, for a large part of the movie.
I just feel like it's 40% towards being a classic, and I watched it going, I remember loving this. And he slides down, then he puts on the trousers, and I know this is a 2020 problem. Like, we're looking at it going, well, it's a different time. But I still think they could have fixed this. I think this was a first pass script. I'm being so shady now. but it felt a bit first pass. Whereas I think, despite all its overblownness, Christmas Chronicles kind of knew what it was doing.
Mm. Yeah.
It goes, okay, so Santa Claus is selling you the idea that your dad becomes Santa. And then it's selling you the idea of what happened if your dad became Santa and what would it like to be your son being the kid in the sleigh and you go off on an adventure. Christmas Chronicles knows you love elves. You love toys. You love random tech babble. You love slaying through the sky. And I think it delivers a lot more fun family deliverables, so to speak.
I mean, does it make a difference that, you know, obviously the Santa Claus is directed by John Pasquin, who is a regular Tim Allen guy. He was one of the key directors on Home Improvement. He's worked with Tim Allen on a number of films. Whereas Christmas Chronicles, both of them were directed by Chris Columbus, who has a lot of form in Christmas movies, not least, of course, Home Alone. So does it help that he maybe, like, he does seem to kind of chime with Christmassiness, technical term, in maybe a way that other directors don't? I mean, imagine for a moment, by the way, like, we're talking about divorce and custody battles and so on, but imagine that the heart of The Santa Claus had been directed by, say, a Steven Spielberg, yeah. someone who is excellent at divorce and custody battles yeah. and adjusting to a new normal for kids. You know, that could have worked maybe with someone, you know, with, again, just a little more heart injected into that story.
Yeah, and maybe with a bigger budget, dare I say it.
That is also a factor with Christmas movies, you're right.
I watched The Santa Claus going, shoot, you need to have at least three scenes on the bounce, which are just people talking. You know when you're watching the bottle episode of your favorite show and you go, yeah. oh, yeah, okay. So this is the Star Trek episode where they have a big conversation. Okay, yep.
yep. They're saving up for a finale. It'll all pay off in the
It'll
end.
It'll pay off in the end and they'll float above the sky. Whereas Christmas, Chronicles 2, even more than the first one, is a proper carpet bomb of money. It is a constant glitter shower of cash. The CGI is everywhere. They've got my least favorite bit of the first film were the elves. And they go, we hear you, Ali. Let's make a whole movie about them. there is so much CGI and money in this film. There is so much of it. I couldn't believe just how... I fully thought it was one of the most expensive-looking Christmas movies I've ever seen.
It probably was. But I think this is where, like, it just would have been nice to strike a balance, because, again, for coming back to The Santa Claus, I don't think it spent nearly enough time in that world. And they had such great potential there. I mean, if you look at David Krumholtz's Bernard, like, I would have liked to have seen a film just with him in it, to be honest.
Just about Bernard.
Yep. Just about Bernard. And it was the kind of film where you didn't need a huge amount of CGI to make that side of, or the mythology around Father Christmas, like, great and funny and contemporary and relevant and wonderful. And then, as Ali says, on the other hand, you have this just glitter bomb of... I don't even know how to describe the elves. They're pint-sized. They've got massive eyes.
Literally, yeah.
They're literally pint-sized. They've got some pretty... I'm looking at Ali's facial hair right now, and it's not far off in some cases. They speak... What is the language?
That is Elvish. Right. And it was created, I believe, for the films. And there is a fantastic Kurt Russell quote in an interview he did for this film, talking about the fact that he thought if he spoke in Elvish to the elves, that it would add to the authenticity of the movie, which is just such a delightful thought. It stopped me in my tracks, that quote. It's lovely.
What I love about quotes like that is, I think as human beings, we actually live and thrive on having conversations face to face or over phone calls like this, where it makes sense within context. But that is such a don't write that down. Just don't write it down. When that's in print, oh no. Yeah. He's right. But, I tell you what, it always feels cynical when you watch a kid's movie and you go, oh, they're the minions. They're the minions.
Yeah.
Got it. You know, you're watching, yep. you know, watching Madagascar and you go, penguins, got it. Yep, there they are.
Yep.
And it happens so often in kids' movies. I mean, even Frozen obviously has, to an extent, our little stony trolls. So they're everywhere, but they really double down on this one. Can we talk about how our friend from Deadpool 2 and Hunt for the Wilder People looks as an elf?
They've managed to make him look vaguely like himself.
Yes.
In a strange way as an elf.
I love what they were trying to do. I think at times I found myself going, this is like a gremlin. Gremlins.
With the ears and the little kind of paw hands.
I have to say I laughed out loud when he's becoming bad and he suddenly starts wearing leather jackets with cut-off sleeves.
There is a real BDSM vibe about it. I love it.
Just loved it. How can we indicate that he's bad? Whoopee cushions, breaking another elf's back, pushing him down some stairs and throwing presents at his head. Leather jacket.
It's a very sort of 1950s version of what a delinquent looks like, isn't it?
He's about to do a chicky run with Santa with the sleighs at the end.
I would like to say something for Julian Dennison at this moment. So he's obviously been cast as a bad egg in several films now. And I met him, I interviewed him for Hunt for the Wilder People, one of the greatest movies of the last 10 years. And he was there with his mum, And I've got to say, he is one of the most polite, well-spoken, you know, delightful young people I have ever had the pleasure of interviewing. And like literally wouldn't curse in front of his mum when we were discussing some of the lines in the film. So I would like somebody out there, please, to cast him as a nice kid soon. That would be lovely if you could. Thank you very much. I feel like he deserves better than always being the bad egg.
I did like him in this.
That said, he did commit really, like, fantastically. I really enjoyed seeing him being the surly kid who just wants Kurt Russell to love him. Like we all do.
Like, I think a lot of Santa movies are essentially daddy issues, and I know you love that as a movie topic, Helen, but it's just daddy issues. And even the elf has the daddy. It's just everywhere. Yeah.
Everywhere. I mean, Kurt Russell in this is, I believe I'm right in saying, a zaddy.
Well,
and not just a daddy.
I'll tell you what, he's not a snack, he's a meal. Ooh, what a man.
Cut me a slice
of that Christmas pudding. Could we talk about the fact that this movie throws everything at the screen, Christmas Chronicles 2? You know you're in for a good time and you can just disengage brain, where they go two-thirds of the way through, how about some time travel? I feel like there's a game to be played on Twitter of what movie would be improved if at the beginning of the third act they chucked in time travel, because it is a baller bit of script writing to go not the first act, not the second act, at the final stretch of my movie we are going to have time travel. It is amazing.
it was quite inexplicable to me. I got where they were going in the end, obviously, and I did get there, to my credit, slightly before the stars did. It was like, oh, that's gonna be her dad. Closure. But I was just like, why are we time traveling? Why is there more plot happening? I don't want more plot.
This film needs more plot. We're running out of plot. Said no one. Also, can we just take a moment to appreciate that the main crux of that whole sequence is, yes, that gorgeous song that you talked about, Beth, but the fact that batteries go off, just get in the bin. That's not a plot point in reality, and that's not a plot point in a film. You've done time travel where you can go wibbly wobbly timey wimey, and then the batteries have gone off.
That is incredibly stabbed.
Also, the idea that Santa doesn't have multiple batteries in his pocket is also offensive. Batteries may not be included with normal toys, but with Santa gifts, there should always be batteries. He should always have batteries handy. It doesn't make any sense otherwise. Now, I will say, in the film's defense, we saw in the first film, there was at the very least a suggestion that Santa set the whole thing up. To kind of restore, to help these two kids, and that the entire plot was something he could easily have sorted out himself, but he wanted to give them yada yada the experience. And I think that's got to be the only possible explanation for the batteries, is that he was trying to set it up so she would meet her dad, she would have that moment of closure, and he could go off and sing with Darlene Love, because who would want to do that?
I mean, Christmas legend. We also need to talk about how in the first film, there is a big plot point where they can't get enough money to get in a cab to go somewhere, so they have to kind of sort of nick the car of some bad guy's car, right? And so he goes up to this lady, and my favorite bits of the Christmas Chronicles movies is where Santa knows everything about you, and he's basically your best friend, and you never known it. He's the guardian angel. He knows what you wanted for Christmas every year. He knows what you really like and who you really are, and that's an amazing, gorgeous superpower. And I think it's of note that the theme, the score to our Kurt Russell Santa, is a superhero theme. When he is on the sleigh, it is Avengers for sure. But there's this bit where he goes up to the maitre d' of a Irish bar and says, "Do you have any money?"
And she maitre d's of Irish bars.
And she goes, "I ain't got no money." And you go, "Okay, well that's the rest of the plot," and off you go. In this movie, he sees a mall Santa trying to raise money for charity. Money, money, money coming out that bucket. No problem. He's got the money now.
What the?
I'm telling you, he set the whole thing up. He can do whatever he wants, and he just forgets.
Yoda. You are Yoda.
I actually have my Christmas Yoda here with me. Just
his little candy cane.
His little candy cane cane. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I do want to talk about Mrs. Claus in a minute as well, but speaking of these two Santas, is there something in the idea that every generation gets maybe the Santa they deserve, but certainly that the Santas we get say something about the time we're in. You know, there's a very different Santa in Santa Claus the Movie to the Santa Claus to Christmas Chronicles. You know, there is some kind of change in terms of what he can do, what his priorities are, you know, what his focus is between all of these different portrayals, it feels like.
I'm thinking about my favorite Father Christmas, which is Raymond Briggs' Father Christmas. Where all he wants is a holiday. He just wants to breathe in. Yeah. He just wants to go to Vegas and eat steak. And I just think there's something so lovely about, you know, recognizing the labor that goes into being Father Christmas and the endurance and the idea that maybe just sometimes he needs a bit of a break, which is...
Yeah.
As we say, your parents, you know, the labor and the thought and the just the responsibility of being a parent. And then like, I just want to go and lie in a swimming pool. I just want to go out in a caravan and forget about all my troubles for a little while. So yeah, I think
just a warm pair of slippers. That's all he needs, that one.
And there are obviously timeless traits, but you're right. Like the mythology often changes. I think Kurt Russell is very much our Father Christmas. I'm struggling to think of anyone else that kind of...
What does that say about us? We're just sexier than people used to be
absolutely.
In the past?
I mean,
I love how he won't allow himself a full white beard because Kurt Russell, you know.
I know.
Still got...
I'm genuinely convinced that the Santa Chronicles came about, Christmas Chronicles, sorry, came about because somebody watched Hateful Eight and was just like, that beard, we need more of that beard. Look at that beard. Good Lord. And that is genuinely the impetus for this entire franchise.
I will sound like a really weak source media studies student, which I guess I am in so many ways, but you can look at the Christmas Chronicles Santa as the benevolent God, as the all-knowing, all-seeing, ultimately knows what's going on. He's got his hand on the tiller. What he does in both movies is resolves family issues, trauma, distrust. He is the God, and I mean this in the kind of big white beard, kind of Christian type God, that knows all and just wants to guide you towards a sense of self-knowledge and realization.
Your best life kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
He's not going to fix it for you, but he will do lots of magical, sparkly stuff to kind of nudge you into the correct way. And that is kind of, I think, the fantasy right now, is that we all want to get along, but increasingly we are being triggered and just storming out and making our own mess. And look, I know this is, again, a bad media studies essay, but that's why these movies are such good fantasies right now, is because we would love to all be getting along, but we need this impartial, benevolent, wonderful, all-knowing person to just get us in the same room and sort it out. You know, when Julian Dennison is storming off, even then, the Christmas Chronicles, Kurt Russell Santa is saying, don't go. You've spray-painted my sleigh and been a total nightmare, but we still don't want you to go.
Yeah.
And look, I know this is weak, but I do think that's different to, for example, the Bad Santa, or this 90s, Santa, which is all about himself and him unscrooging himself.
Which he wasn't even that scroogey. Like, he literally works at a toy company. Now, admittedly, the first thing we see him doing is interrupting female black colleague, which is not a great look.
And then it cuts to a fake Santa with a lady on his lap.
Yeah.
It was like,
it's a very cynical time, but extending the metaphor in that case, that's the sort of apotheosis, right? That's the man becoming God in the 90s. So maybe they felt like they had a little bit more power back then in an era of, you know, economic stability
agency,
and relative world peace, agency. So all they, you know, they thought, okay, we're on a steady upward climb here. Things are getting better. And right now we're like, just somebody tell us how to fix it, please.
Is it not?
Can somebody?
Please, someone take the tiller and just lead us where we need to go.
Also, Santa take the wheel.
It felt so 90s when he has that scene in the Santa Claus where he comes in with some great BS saying, oh yeah, all my clothes got damaged by the dry cleaner and I only have this. And then he orders all the food. And I just think, isn't it very 90s that you have so much money in your toy company that you're just going to order in like lobster thermidor? Whatever. Anyway.
Oh, dreams.
Dreams, yeah. Exactly. Dreams. Imagine halfway through an Empire magazine meeting, Terry just goes, you know what? Let's get it. Bring it in. Yeah. I'll have the suckling pig. Lovely stuff.
I'll have the salad dressing on the side.
you'll be lucky if you get someone running to Pret at most magazines these days, you know. But yeah, it's perhaps a slightly dark portrayal of where we are as a species. Let's talk about Mrs. Claus, though. Now, obviously, the brief didn't include the Santa Claus 2, where Santa has to get married by Christmas Eve because of reasons in the even smaller print. So that we'll leave that aside. But Mrs. Claus was one of the big attractions of the Christmas Chronicles 2, because of course Goldie Hawn cameos at the very end of the first one, but only really comes into play here. Now, my big problem with this film really overall was actually that you don't hire Goldie Hawn and then not give her hilarious things to do.
Preach, yeah. Helen, preach.
Yeah. And she is sort of kind of, her traits are sort of whittled down to this idea that she just wants to be a mum. You know, she's Mrs. Claus, but what she's really missing is her own children to sit down with and dote on. And it's like, you've created this whole town, which, to be fair, they do recognise, and they push that in one of the slightly more subtle pushes for like forced feminism that I've seen in a while. I'm looking at you, Endgame. so that is, I mean, I'll take my wins where I can. But you're right. I just feel like she was vastly underused. I think everything got piled onto Kurt, and Goldie just read bedtime stories, which is a shame.
She just has to be sweet.
Nursing a reindeer was her big moment.
Yeah. She didn't get to go. She had to send a kid off to go and do a heavy lifting for her while she tended to a dying reindeer.
Yeah, it is disappointing. I mean, the thing about the kids angle was done before, I think, better in my personal childhood Santa movie, which was Santa Claus the Movie. Imaginative title there. It must have taken them a really long time to come up with it. But in that one, you know, it is a plot point that these two never had kids, that they wanted them, and that is why they essentially become Santa and Mrs. Claus. That is why they are chosen to become Santa and Mrs. Claus, because they can, this way they can love all the children in the world. And it's actually, I mean, it's a really good basic premise. The problem is when you don't maybe play it that well. And you know, I don't think this film goes all the way with that. Now, you know, I think there are moments where both Goldie Hawn and Kurt Russell do it really beautifully, actually. And I think that final scene with Julian Dennison is really nice, because you can see that there's actual care for him there. They want him back. There isn't anger so much as just compassion.
And you,
I think,
buy it.
I thought that was lovely.
You just buy
you
it.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You do. But it did feel a little forced in a way that I didn't want it to.
She bakes cookies. I know that's kind of the Mrs. Claus thing, but could we? Look, I didn't want her to rock up like Tank Girl with a bazooka, but I
did.
Okay. As soon as I said it, Beth, I was like, what was I thinking?
What am I saying?
Because that's like the Santa Claus, where that guy comes up with Santa tank, and he's anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So I just felt like, I just wanted her to do something. I wanted her to do something.
Just be Goldie Hawn.
Just be Goldie Hawn.
Look,
instead of the first wife, she was the first wife.
Yeah.
And even in the first wife's club, she was better than this. She's better used.
She's potusing around.
Yeah, my only hope is, because it is Chronicles, the Christmas Chronicles 3 is her story. That's the only thing I can hope we kind of come up with. But yeah,
that's a shame.
Yeah. Sorry, briefly talk about the third one, Santa Claus 3. Is when I think they just go, let's go bonkers, and they bring in Jack Frost.
That was Martin Short,
right? Martin Short, that's right. Who is camping it up, having a great time. I wouldn't be against that level of bananarosity for the third one.
Mm.
I don't want them to expand the universe anymore, thanks. And look, we can have fun with this Christmas Chronicles movie too. Going, by the way, North Pole has trees on it, does it? That's pretty interesting. Yeah. Really?
Well, I mean, it's magic, Ali. It's magic.
The Aurora Borealis.
Over
the,
Christmas. Just,
so again, you can't come at this movie with logic, obviously.
But I have to say, I mean, that in its defense, every single Santa movie seems to make that mistake, which is they all say Santa's workshop, and some of them actually go, it's underground at the North Pole, which is, of course, water.
Yeah.
It's entirely water. So...
There's been some song that said North Pole, because I grew up with him living in Lapland.
Mm.
That's,
yeah,
that's,
yeah.
And that's the image you have and this is such like separating the peas on a plate, but it was like,
it really is.
Lapland. We all know what that means, right? It's Norway and Finland and okay, great.
It's very north. It's very far north, like in its defense, you know, it's just not quite North Pole. Yeah. One thing I think that both films do well, and I think we should give credit where it's due for a minute, is in the kids.
Yeah.
Because within seconds of meeting Jack in this film, I would have died for him. Like, he is absolutely adorable. And I thought that, you know, little Darby Camp was very sweet in the first film. And she manages to be sweet even when being a lot more teenage and a lot more angst here.
So great.
But Jack was where it was at for me. He was adorable. And I think that's true as well of Charlie in The Santa Claus. Like, you desperately want the best for this kid because he just seems really sweet.
I was worried Jack was going to be a nebbish Woody Allen impersonation, and he's not. And I think that is traditionally how the anxious kid is done. Mm. And actually you go, no, I get it. You lost your mum. Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
No judgment here. Your dad is working on it, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I entirely agree. I think at first I was a bit worried about anxiety kid, but we got there. And I think he was really good with the whole cookie thing. I know you could see it from a mile away, but I liked it. Yeah. By the way, bloody hell, an explosive cookie for a, what was it, a puma, which is called a Yule puma or something? What's the?
Yule cats.
Yule cats.
Because of reasons. I mean, I didn't. Snow leopards don't live in that part of this. You know what? Never mind.
It's Christmas. Yeah, moving on.
Any plot hole, any inconsistencies, you just get a big brush and go Christmas. And
exactly.
Paint across all of it. Christmas in the North Pole, Christmas. Snow puma, Christmas. It's all you can do. It's like in The Simpsons when they're like, it's wizards. Wizards did it. It's Christmas.
Wizards
Christmas.
Did it.
Wizards did it.
Wizards did it. Yeah, he does have a pointy hat. You know, it doesn't say wizard on it, but he can have everything.
You can agree.
Like, why is Malcolm McDowell an a Turkish elf that speaks English?
Beth, thank you for bringing that up. That's when I went, this movie has gorged itself on plot.
Yeah.
It is stuffed to the ribs with plot.
It is.
Do we need factions of elves? Is that a thing that we need for our universe to be complete?
Also, a big proper chuckle at, I didn't expect Turkey to look like this. So good.
No.
So good. Can we talk briefly, please, Helen, shut me down, but no, can we talk briefly about how the Santa Claus very much ignores all concept of Christian faith? And
yes.
And this is very interesting, the Christmas Chronicles, that it really does homogenize, commodify, McDonald's-ificate Christianity's own myth-making. The Star of Bethlehem is
mentioned.
The boondoggle MacGuffin doodad that powers the Christmas. That is, you are skating on some interesting ice. And they really do acknowledge that he was Saint Nick. He was the guy that just liked giving presents to kids, which is totally fine. And, you know, that's interesting that they do that, because a lot of Christmas movies, particularly Santa films, just ignore it. Just ignore it.
I mean, it is a secular as well as, I think, a religious holiday these days. You know, it's a really interesting fine line to walk, isn't it? I know Jewish people who celebrate Christmas. I know Muslim people who celebrate Christmas, and because it's just fun, right? It's, you know, with trees and sparkly lights. I mean, sparkly things.
Winter solstice, hooray!
It's a tradition.
Yes, Wiccan, everybody. Yeah, and Christmas, of course, as you point out, is basically stolen from like 16 different faiths to begin with. So, fine, cool. But yeah, sometimes it does feel a little bit more
they've turned
commercialized than others.
A portion of the Christmas story into unobtainium. And that's interesting. That is basically my only point. I don't have much more to add, but I think it's interesting that they felt the confidence to do that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think they have you can walk a line between coupling and uncoupling the Santa myth. Like, again, Miracle on 34th Street, there are elements of Christianity in there. Mm-hmm. At the very least, they get married in a church. You know, that's something. Chris has clearly put in a word with that priest. But but yeah, I mean, the Santa Claus is entirely secular. And the fact that he is working in a toy company to begin with does once again, you know, indicate it's a little bit commercial as well.
Yeah, it reminded me a bit of Big in that way.
Mm.
Well, you're having this body change comedy setup, and there's the toys and, you know, all the rest of it.
That's fair.
Hello, I'm Sam Pay.
And I'm Martin Zott-Sorstwick.
And together we host a show called Song by Song, where we deal with the music of Tom Waits. We've been going since 2015. Every week we talk about a new track. We've made our way through 15 seasons so far of his music.
And now we're going back to the early years. And if you haven't listened to Tom Waits before, it's not the growly stuff. It's not the stuff where he's hitting an automobile with a bone for percussion. It's a nice, easy way into his music.
If that sounds like something you would be interested in, you should check out our website, songbysongpodcast.com, or put Song by Song into your podcatcher of choice.
All right, I think we should probably wrap this up because we're getting on in terms of time. So we have to look at two criterion here, the Christmassiness and the objective quality. Let's start with Christmassiness. I feel like both of these films are going to score quite high here. I've been completely inconsistent because I'm a terrible podcast host. We can either score it out of 5 or out of 10, whichever you would like. But the Christmassiness of both films, please.
Out of five.
Either. Yeah, I've been completely inconsistent. So at this point,
I mean, the Christmas Chronicles 2, as I say, it falls in, going back to what I first said, in terms of just like gargantuan glitter ball, like can barely look at it for Christmas. I think probably 10, what we do, like 10 candy canes?
Yeah.
Out of 10 candy canes.
10 candy canes.
In that respect. Yeah. I thought it was really charming. I liked that Russell, you know, a stalwart in like action films, hasn't been kind of made the butt of a joke. I like a lot of they take a lot of action stars, they take Dwayne Johnson and make him the Tooth Fairy. Was that the one he was in? And the pacifier, and kind of puts them in these very kind of feminine or, you know, soft surroundings. And that's kind of the joke. But he kind of holds on to his integrity here, which I really liked. And the kids stole the show for me. So I'll say 7 candy canes, if I'm doing this. I just made up my own currency here, so I do apologize. But and then the Santa Claus... Yeah, a little bit of a lump of coal there in the heart of Christmas. So I'll say 6 candy canes on the Christmas front. I mean, for the kid alone, we're talking 7 candy canes.
I wonder with Christmas Chronicles 2 about how Christmassy it makes me feel. And I don't know how Christmassy it makes me feel, in so much as that it is a big romping, throw everything in it, adventure story with Santa trappings on it. So I think it's a 7 as well. It sure looks the part and it's got all the Christmas ingredients. But I think the first Christmas Chronicles, which I keep bringing up and I apologize, is in of itself purer on the Christmas factor. Mm. So I think it's 7 candy canes for me for Christmas Chronicles. And I think the Santa Claus's concept, as I keep banging on about, is a 9er in the Christmas factor. I think that is gold. I think in the pitch meeting, that's gold. Your dad becomes Santa. The execution just doesn't come together. So I think it is a 5 for me.
Okay.
And I'm actually really quite gutted that Santa Claus was as Kringle versus Kringle as I had no memory of it being, because I think as a child, I just have forgotten all boring stuff.
Yeah. I did enjoy the Judge Reinhold character in that. I thought he was just the right side of annoying. Yeah. And
he's not Ned from Groundhog Day. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also like, again, referring to the sequel, which, you know, is not in the brief, but, you know, their marriage works out. It's not like she suddenly leaves him and goes back to Scott Calvin. And I thought that was a smart piece of storytelling, actually. I think that's the right thing to do, because he's not a bad guy. No. He's just a nerd, really, which is good. And yeah, they're interestingly, that plot device about parents being convinced by getting the present they should have gotten in childhood is used a lot in these movies. It comes up in Fred Claus as well. It redeems the villain of Fred Claus.
I had a good time with Weenie Whistle. There was something about watching Judge Reinhold having to act his socks off a Weenie Whistle, just going, you need to sell this because this is the apex of the movie.
All we got.
So just act, Judge. More. Act more. I couldn't believe it. And it was so tiny. Oh, and also, I forget the actress's name, when the parachuted presents land on her head and she has to go, oh, right, jump, yep. No, that's the take. We've only got one parachute drop, so. I would love it if secretly there's a deleted scene where that's Operation Christmas Drop and it wasn't set.
if only that were Operation Christmas Drop, that would have been fun. Did you do both? I can't remember if I interrupted you.
Quality to do, yeah.
Quality, okay. In terms of Christmassiness, I think I agree with you. I think in terms of looks, I mean, Christmas Chronicles 2 is like a 14 out of 10. Like it is insanely Christmassy looking. It could not look more Christmassy. I don't think there's a single inch of the screen that looks out of place that way. Even when they're in Hawaii, you're like, yes, is the kind of Christmas holiday I would like.
I hate to correct you. Cancun, darling.
Cancun, I apologize.
Cancun.
Thank you.
I was just...
But yes.
A Feliz Navidad as an opening to a movie makes me go, yeah, Feliz Navidad. Love it. It's a banger.
It is a banger. There's some great Christmas tunes. And that's another thing you can tell the good Christmas movies from the cheap ones. They have the money for the hits.
The budget. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The budget. The musical budget is there. But yes, anyway, so I agree with you. Overall, I think it doesn't always have quite as much heart as you want, but I think it's still a 7 or an 8 for me, Christmas Chronicles 2, because it is, you know, it does still have Kurt Russell as Santa and Darlene Love singing a Christmas song. So I'm like, that is, I don't need much more than that for a Christmas. And then the Santa Claus looks the part. Interesting depiction of the North Pole, I think. Interesting use of kids as elves, like unaltered kids. You know, Fred Claus kind of maps adult faces onto children in a slightly horrifying way. But this one just has kids and it kind of works. They're kind of fun. So, but a lot of it does take place around the rest of the year. So I think that's probably a 6
for me.
Yeah.
You know, I like the joke from the girl going, it's just, I'm 1,000 years old, or you look good for your age, or blah, blah, blah. It's very 90s. It's very stand-up routine, but I kind of enjoy it.
Yeah, it's cheesy. And then objective quality, a slightly tougher measure, perhaps, for these two films.
I can jump in if you want me to.
Yeah.
I thought I'd done it, sorry, with the...
Yeah, you kind of did, actually, I think.
But, I think it's on me. The rest of it haven't. I would say, frankly, I think Christmas Chronicles isn't as good as I wanted it to be. I think it is bloated, and I think it needed trimming down. I would give it
not trimming the tree.
No. 6.5. I think I'd go for, and I think Santa Claus, sadly, it gives me no pleasure, is a 5 as well.
I am actually going to go exactly the same. I think it's. I enjoyed the first Christmas Chronicles. I there's lots to enjoy in this one. I just, you know, with plots for these movies in particular, I'm very much of the keep it simple, stupid kind of school of thought. Like the more streamlined, the more elegant you can make your plot, the better. Mm. And both of these get a little bit lost in the weeds at times, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay, well, that is basically it in that case. Thank you so much to Beth Webb and Ali Plum. Where can people find you guys for more of your wisdom and insights?
Well, I'm Beth K. Webb on Twitter. And if you ever want to find out about the Bechdel Test Fest and what we're up to and what we're about, we are at Bechdel Test Fest.
Easy enough.
My name is Ali Plum and I'm on the internet. My name has a B on the end, so it's ALIPLUMB. And yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and all that banana. And sometimes on YouTube and the iPlayer and something called British Broadcasting Corporation Radio 1 Radio. So yeah, I'm everywhere. I'm like a bad smell. You can't get rid of me.
Wouldn't want to, Ali. Wouldn't want to. You smell of cinnamons and oranges.
Oh, too very kind. Christmassy. Too kind.
Well, that is all for today. Thank you so much for joining us, everybody. And Merry Christmas.
Ho, ho, ho. Merry Christmas.
If you've enjoyed listening to Bah Humbug, please give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts because it really helps other people find the show. You can also subscribe so you automatically get the rest of this podcast lined up hassle-free, and it's only going to be a limited run up to Christmas. It won't be using up all your data. If you'd like to hear more from me, you can pre-order my book, Women vs. Hollywood, The Fall and Rise of Women in Film, which comes out in February 2021. You can also, of course, find me in Empire Magazine, which is the world's best film magazine for my money. And I'm on the Empire podcast every week and host the podcast His Darker Materials to coincide with BBC HBO drama His Dark Materials. If you'd like to connect with me or comment on the show or have any queries or comments, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Helen L. O'Hara, or you can email producers@stripped.media. And I'd like to thank all the people who have made this podcast happen. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits this podcast, as well as Tom Wally, Dave Corkery and Kobe Omanaka, who've all helped produce and put this show together. Thanks also to all of my guests who have been absolutely wonderful in giving up their time to watch some Christmas films that are not always 100% great. If you'd like to know more about this podcast and others produced by Strip Media, please visit www.stripped.media to find out more. And that's it. Merry Christmas.
You just heard a Stripped Media production.